phenomena where composers and lyricists tackled topics as varied as a new line of earth-moving equipment or absorbent paper hospital undergarments with vigor and aplomb. Incredibly rare, rich with subtext, and infinitely uncool, welcome to the story of the industrial musical on record. To develop a precise definition of this little-known genre, also called the industrial show, it helps to flesh out its origins, which are, like a lot of its history, murky and undocumented. Sometime during the immediate post-World War II industry boom, thriving companies must have been searching for something livelier to entertain their managers and salespeople with during conferences and conventions. For decades, they had made use of corporate anthems, the audio equivalent of a two-minute pep rally, as well as training and industrial films. But with the advent of the long-playing record, another use began to rear its head. All available evidence points to the automobile makers as the first companies to turn to musical theater when they began expanding their annual announcement shows, which is where they would introduce new models to their salesmen at conventions, into full-fledged Broadway-styled extravaganzas. How this decision was made, no one can be sure, and precisely when companies decided to give salesmen souvenir recordings of the musical highlights from their company's stage shows can't be pinpointed either. What we do know is that sometime in the late 1940s, Oldsmobile staged an announcement show that doubled as musical motivational theater. Here's an excerpt from the innocent, earliest existing recorded industrial show. Track one, please.
How you doing, dealers and your salesmen? How you doing at the dealer show?
We are glad that you are here.
Yes, we're glad that you are here.
Glad you're here.
Glad you're here.
To make this year.
Make this year. The biggest, best year that we've ever had before. The biggest, best year in our history. Let's go, let's go, let's go, let's go, let's go.
It was pretty tame stuff. But by 1954, while rolling in profits from their rocket engines, Old staged the mammoth Mighty O, a costly production performed for a few nights in New York City for employees, which featured a young Bob Fosse and company rallying the troops with songs such as Panoramic Windshield. Let's hear number two.
Panoramic windshield.
Panoramic windshield.
The new sled-in windshield design. Panoramic windshield.
Panoramic windshield.
Brand new 54 lines.
You
see all around you.
You look all around you.
No post here to shut off the view.
You're right.
Panoramic windshield.
Panoramic windshield.
That's for me.
At approximately the same time, Buick and Pontiac got into the act. Retail giants like W.T. Grant and Marshall Fields began staging shows for their employees. In the 1950s, this nascent genre was born, and its definition solidified. An industrial musical can be defined as a musical production staged explicitly for employees of a corporation that features songs and lyrics meant to motivate, inform, or educate their workforce. Thousands of shows were staged between 1950 and 1985. A comparatively minuscule 200 or so privately pressed records of these performances have been discovered. Early industrial musicals had basic plots and were quite similar in tone. Take, for example, the Oldsmobile show I just mentioned. Olds privately pressed a show on record nearly every year until 1963, and most of them starred the same person, Florence Henderson. There was the 1955 show, which had an Alibaba theme, for instance. But despite the fact that they made fancy tickets and phony playbills, musically, they were exceptionally bad. Yet lyrically, things were beginning to get interesting. Stage shows had to be entertaining, of course, but the lyrics of these shows had to address and reinforce certain ideas. Naturally, a show had to educate workers about salesmanship and about new product details. Second, the show had to motivate the workers to sell by making them believe in the value of their employer's product. And third, the lyrics had to demonstrate that working for a corporation is a high calling. There's nothing particularly strange about these ideas, but add a brass section and dramatic Tin Pan Alley voices, and you're presented with a stunning disconnect. As far as automobile musicals were concerned, the quality belonged to Ford. Track three, please.
We're the engineers who work at Ford, and from Ford we draw our pay. We decide on design, we may think it's fine, but the people have the final say. We heard that the people would like to buy a car with features that are new. So Ford went out and studied the market and found that it was absolutely true.
Ford would hire talented composers and lyricists to write their shows, one of them being a man named Lloyd Norlin, who would be one of the first of many composer-lyricists who would have long, successful careers in industrials. He wrote at least four shows for Ford, as well as Marshall Field's, Ham's Beer, and a true classic, the 1957 Standard Oil show, The Big Change. Norlin's work was, like many of the shows of the 1950s, at times simple and bombastic, but his lyrics tended to focus on the corporation listening to its buyers and building successful relationships within the company. Ford can also claim two major Broadway talents as early show writers. Jerry Bock and Sheldon Harnick, before writing Fiddler on the Roof, wrote Music to Fortify Your Future. The 1959 Ford Tractor musical. The extremely difficult to locate Ford Edsel show, on the other hand, remains uncredited. Other corners of industry regularly produced shows during the 1950s. Several shows by General Electric's heating and cooling divisions have turned up, along with shows by Electrolux and DuPont. However, the masterpiece of the 1950s industrial show appeared in 1958, The Shape of Tomorrow, billed as a musical introduction to 1958 Westinghouse appliances. The show was written by Herb Kanzel, a young talent from the Midwest, and it's overflowing with Westinghouse pride as well as lyrical density. And by that, I'm referring to the difficult job the songwriters sometimes had of cramming massive amounts of product detail into the confines of musical theater. Track four, please.
A new cold injector sends a jet stream of air to bring colder temperatures to all the booths there. The cheese server, water server, meat keeper too. Make sure your food stay fresh and stay in view. And here on the front is the magnetic door. But don't run away because there's plenty more. More from the shape of tomorrow that we've got right here for you today. A separate freezer that holds oh so much and opens with just the slightest tiptoe touch.
This is the shape of tomorrow, and we got it here for you today.
Five wraparound freeze plates that are sure to please and seal in the flavor of the foods you freeze.
This is the shape of tomorrow, and we got it here for you today.
The popularity of this new type of entertainment spread. By 1961, another industry giant had begun treating their employees to these musical souvenirs, Coca-Cola. Coke's shows of the 1960s and 1970s have the dubious honor of being perhaps the most coldly pragmatic of the genre. The title of their 75th anniversary show says it all: The Grip of Leadership. Here's a clip from the track Packaging and Pricing, number five.
Now I look at packaging and pricing as a great big pair of pliers, especially designed with us in mind, and that means you and me.
Pack packaging and pricing, a pair of pliers.
Simple as ABC. Pliers to get a grip on profit. Profit from the business, yes siree. Now I take these pliers, packaging and pricing, working together like so.
Oh, how are you gonna work it with a pair of pliers? Tell us so we'll know.
I'll take them in a grip of iron and squeeze, Mr. Squeeze.
He's gonna take them in a grip of iron and squeeze.
Gonna squeeze the starch out of competition with my great big pair of pliers. Squeeze so hard he'll have nothing left but his unrequited buyers.
Coke's shows were written by another industrial mainstay, Wilson Stone, who had honed his skills for both Broadway and Hollywood. Stone's Coca-Cola shows were so popular among the big brass, they were translated and exported to Germany. Here's the cover of the 1963 German Coke show. In some instances, his shows were rewritten slightly and given to Coke subsidiaries. Minute Maid, for instance. But Stone didn't exclusively work for Coca-Cola. Like many others, he freelanced. He took over from where Bach and Harnick left off and wrote the 1960 Ford Tractor Show, the 1964 Ford Tractor Show, and one of my personal favorites, the 1963 Xerox Show, Take It From Here, the show produced to introduce their first desktop copier. Here Stone uses a common industrial musical plotline, the story of a young gee-whiz type named Charlie who has just been hired at Xerox and his complete integration into corporate life proceeds to then unfold. I think I should probably skip this
You're
one.
You're really a very lucky man.
Okay, never mind.
Just copy it.
Anyway, it's for the 8:13.
If you can go on to an extra 5 minutes. You've got an hour and a half.
Okay, great. Thank you. If it doesn't seem obvious already, these shows were purely ephemeral entertainment. The companies retained the rights to the music and lyrics, and the records often bore large warnings against virtually any promotion or airplay whatsoever. If the records were saved at all, they were usually not played, although the mere fact that many were pressed onto records suggests that corporations meant for their workers to keep the souvenir recordings to listen to on their own to relive those joyous moments for the company. Judging strictly by how few copies of these shows have turned up in the past 12 years, the pressing runs can be approximated at about 2,000 for a large show and perhaps 200 or even less for a low-budget show. So if this really is musical detritus, let's dig a little bit deeper. From about 1963 to the early 70s, the genre experienced its heyday. As annual grosses expanded, so did the shows. Thriving companies in almost every aspect of American industry began pressing recordings of their semi-secret in-house corporate entertainment with gatefold covers, inserts, lyric sheets, and occasionally even sheet music. The retail industry, for instance. Michael Brown was a Broadway alumnus who specialized in songs with deft, amusing wordplay in shows for JCPenney's, such as Penny Proud, seen here. He also wrote shows for Belk's department stores, Talon Zippers, Woolworth's, and a true classic, Singers Sing a Song of Sewing. Let's hear track 7.
We're so, 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 so happy to be so, so, sewing at home. We're so, 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 so happy when we say we sewed it at home. We picked the pattern, the fabric, the notion, then we got it going. With thank you to dear Mr. Singer for those aids to sewing. We're so, 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 so happy to be so, so, sewing at home. We're so...
Design for these souvenir albums varied. At times, they actively mimicked Broadway design, such as Bright Idea, a Fairy Tale by the Cole National Corporation. However, in this case, inside, you get a low-budget recording of the clunky strains of Cole's show about their new line of color-coded car keys. Sometimes the jackets contained actual photos from the show, such as Colgate's Opportunity Unlimited. Or the scarce Goodyear show, That's Showbiz, which was performed in order to introduce their new product, Prime Wrap, which was a plastic wrap for meats. Then again, some records that appear suspiciously to be drab sales meeting albums actually contain full-fledged product song mania, such as the 1965 Schmitz Beer Marketing Meeting LP. The composers and lyricists took more risks during the 60s, and the content became increasingly entertaining. Take the 1963 Westclock show On the Go with Westclocks, shown here, produced for their Chicago marketing conference of that year, and another rarity with only two known copies in existence. Besides being relentlessly upbeat for a show about alarm clocks, the Westclocks show may have also introduced a particularly arcane song subgenre into the fold, the song specifically created to name-drop actual attendees at the conference. It's your track.
Welcome to Sorensen, Pizza Gallic, Victor Klein.
If everybody so liked them, our volume would be fine.
Say hi to Jim Jolly, William B. Lober.
They're the kind of guys that kick the sales goal over.
Howdy to Parkman, Hylas and Priest. These kind of salesmen rate 4 stars apiece.
The corporate sing-along machine kept churning away. The work of the composer and lyricist team of Hank Beebe and Bill Heyer deserves a special mention for Diesel Dazzle, one of several standout shows they wrote during their lengthy careers, this one for the Detroit Diesel Engine Division of General Motors in 1966. Beebe and Heyer had the ability to make singing about things like owning service stations sound almost romantic, and they frequently wrote songs deliberately for the salesmen's wives in attendance at the show. They had boundaries, sure, but they were experimenting. Nothing, however, beats their crowning achievement of the early 70s, Got to Investigate Silicones. For GE's Silicone Products Department, representing some kind of pinnacle in educational silicone propaganda, this music revels in its own absurdity. The centerpiece of the album is a track with the mystical title, The Answer, which in 7 minutes proceeds in song to list every single use for silicones in existence. That's your track
now.
Now
here are a few things you may not know about silicone fluids and where they go. They're used as a defoamer when your instant coffee boils. Also for textile dyeing, petroleum and cooking oils. It's the stabilizer in vinyl and latex foam. Furniture polish, shave and hand cream. It's in every corner of your home. Water repellents, aerosol sprays. The number is fantastic. The release agent for rubber, for metal and for plastic.
Okay. Hank Beebe, Wilson Stone, and Michael Brown are all still alive and all recall with fondness their careers in this anonymous business. The pay was excellent, and it gave them the ability to hone their craft. The best composers were the ones that embraced the work despite its invisibility to the world at large. I would be remiss in not mentioning other works by fine composers working in this arena. There's My Insurance Man by the Continental Assurance Corporation, written by Arnold Midlash and Robert Wiedick. Also the work of Floridian Sonny Kippy, whose known output of 3 shows on record solidified his talent for rousing the troops. His 2 shows for Monroe Calculator Company during the late 60s must have been particularly successful, judging by their high budgets. Again, only a handful of copies have turned up over the years. Not all of the genre's best composers were unknown. In 1966, General Electric produced Go Fly a Kite, a double album for their 5th Utility Executives Conference. It starred future TV star Valerie Harper and was written by John Kander and Fred Ebb right before they became famous for Cabaret. Two shows from the industrial musical's golden age deserve special mention. Now famous among collector circles, The Bathrooms Are Coming, the 1969 musical for American Standard, is difficult to sum up in a sentence or two. A combination feminist and misogynist musical about bathroom fixtures, it still manages to tap toes and drop jaws today. The plot concerns a mythical goddess named Femma, the leader of all women's movements, according to the album jacket, who invites women to start a bathroom revolution. Track 10.
My bathroom is a private kind of place. Very special kind of place. The only place where I can stay, making faces at my face. My bathroom.
And rarest of the rare, with only one known copy, yet somehow important in the timeline of the genre, is the 1971 musical by the Ortho Pharmaceutical Corporation, The Challenge of Change. Yes, a musical written by and for men about selling birth control to women. The show is uncredited and consists mostly of song parodies. Here's an excerpt from their version of There's Nothing Like a Dame.
There is nothing like a dame, nothing in the world. If our products have a claim, it's a happily married dame.
Women turn to us for reliable contraceptive action, not to mention healthy female sexual satisfaction.
There is nothing like a dame in the ortho world. And there's nothing you can name ortho doesn't make for a dame.
Over 20 million dames use the products that we sell.
Whether Delphin foam or diaphragms with ortho cream or gel.
From our intrauterine device to tiny little pill.
One thing for sure, the risk is nil.
Though a married female's...
That's good. Well, the last out before it cut off, it said, though a married female's problems might be myriad, one thing's for sure, she will always get her...
No!
All right. I'm wrapping up. The mid-70s brought change to the industrial musical, and one can distinctly see the difference simply by examining the souvenir albums. Gone were the elaborate pressings from the 60s, and in came cheap, sparse design. While the shows from the 60s had session musicians and small orchestras, later industrials relied on a host of tinny synthesizers and tepid disco numbers. Changes were afoot lyrically as well. The shows of the late 70s may have been cheapened musically, but they became almost cynical when it came to the lyrics. Prime examples of these attitudes can be found in the musicals of Exxon. Their first, The Spirit of Achievement, from 1976, contains the track The Bottom Line. And you don't have to play this, but it basically says that the bottom line is the profit sign. The bottom line is...
With the microphone working. Hey,
That's actually not me.
Nice when you don't have to yell.
From the same show is a song called Dealer Heaven, a fantasy where a group of Exxon managers pray for a heaven where there are, quote, no employee foul-ups. In 1979, Exxon treated their employees to another show, Put Yourself in Their Shoes, which featured a track titled An Exxon Dealer's Wife, where a woman sings about how it's her corporate duty to throw on a mechanic's jumpsuit and help out her gas station-owning husband without pay, even on holidays. Similarly, Coca-Cola expressed identical sentiments in 1979 with their very last industrial on record, The Great Get-Together.
Serving with me, whoa, there you go.
This time, they showcased their own dealer heaven with a song titled That Big Bottling Plant Up in the Sky, where a group of plant managers wrap up their list of fantasies with a line about sending, quote, those boys...
There we go. That's really loud. That's good. Lois Wardell, AIA, is past president.
I got one, two more paragraphs. AIA, guys.
Tim White, AIA, is president-elect.
Yeah, I got one more paragraph. Well, anyway.
Also,
Okay, one more paragraph. Fighting against the... Okay. I'm going to skip ahead. What do these shows mean exactly, and why should anyone care? Sure, they're rare and in many cases obscenely scarce, but interest in them hovers somewhere around the level of records that are broken in half. Broadly speaking, no one knows they're out there, and most who do show little interest in preserving them for archival and historic reasons. As usual, that's been left to enterprising collectors and fans. I believe that by studying these shows, one can not only hear some fine music, amusing and sometimes truly bizarre lyrics, but one can also trace America's post-war economic history, only this time in song. All right.
Mr. Braveheart here.